Yeah.
By the time we're taping this podcast, you had just, well, I guess you got back from Sochi maybe a week and a half ago. How was it? You know, it seemed like, and I know that you did some Super Bowl stuff before you went to Sochi, but there were some people like Lindsey Jones of USA Today and some AP guys, Paul Newberry, who did the Super Bowl and then immediately went to Russia for the entire Olympics. It seems like that's such an exhausting experience. How was it for you? Was it just exhausting?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think it was as exhausting for me as it was for other reporters because I'm based in New York City. So the Super Bowl for me was local this year. I mean, it may never be again, but for this year it was. So that took a little bit of the, you know, just sort of eliminated one bit of travel from my itinerary. So while the turnaround was really great, I mean, the Super Bowl happened Sunday. I left Monday for Sochi. It wasn't as taxing as it probably would have been for others who, you know, they were probably gone for 8 or 9 days from their house, and if they then went to Sochi, they never returned home. So that's, you know, that might be a month or 34 days or 35 days away from home, where for me, I was at least home during the Super Bowl. But, you know, in terms of, like, work productivity and stuff, it was a lot. I mean, Super Bowl week is always a busy week for any of us who covered. I didn't cover the game, but I sort of covered the media around it. And then I popped on a plane Monday to Moscow, and then from Moscow to Sochi.
But how many Olympics have you covered? How many is it for you?
This was number 7, and it started with Salt Lake City in 2002. So I've done every Olympics since 2002.
I've never done an Olympics. I mean, I've done some week-long events, Super Bowl week, the last few years, and various Masters tennis tournaments, things like that. But I don't know, is it just a grind? It seems like your whole viewpoint of the world or world news just gets so myopic covering this one thing, but you can't cover everything. It's just impossible. Just in general, what's it like covering the Olympics?
Well, you know, one of the benefits that I have is that I'm part of a big staff. So, you know, Sports Illustrated sends 33 people, I think, to these Olympics, if you include the photographers, information technology people, and, you know, basically 12 to 13 writers and editors. So, you know, the good thing about that is we can assign people to different sports, to different beats. So it makes covering Olympics, it makes it specific, but it does give you at least a roadmap as to how you want to do it. I cannot imagine if you were a soloist, basically, you know, it'd be really fun, but it'd be, you know, you sort of, it'd be odd Olympics to cover in that, you know, one day you might be at speed skating, the next day you might be at parallel giant slalom, the next day you might be at the downhill. So you would get to see a lot of different things, but you would never really get a feel for the narrative of one particular event. So what we do at Sports Illustrated is we basically assign people specific beats. We got a couple people who are floaters. My job is to set up the day with a reported kind of guide to what you should be paying attention to, and then I float. So, like, I covered some hockey. I did the women's gold medal game. So my responsibilities for the Olympics are not too bad, and then I have a pretty set schedule as to what I have to cover, and then I can float a little bit. And then, you know, like, my colleague Tim Layden's in charge of alpine skiing, so that's what he does. He stays in the mountains the whole time. Michael Farber's a hockey writer, so he's basically assigned to that hockey arena, most likely will not cover any other events. The Winter Olympics, I will say, are much more manageable because there's just that many less events. When it's the summer and you got to double up sometimes on events and stuff like that, it can be a little bit crazy because it's, you know, there's so many events on the program that, you know, you feel like you're working like 24-hour days.
It probably is. I mean, I'm sure there's a big difference between if you're going there as the columnist of a Canadian newspaper versus a part of this big staff. When I worked in Augusta, Georgia, when I covered the Masters and I worked as part of the big Augusta Chronicle team, there was a lot of camaraderie. It was great because you felt like you're part of this big team that everybody was reading, and you were the biggest voice, I guess, at least at that time with newspapers. And then when I went back, a year later when I was in Cincinnati, I was by myself and it felt much, much different and much, much less fun. So I imagine if you're going with a big group of people and you all have budget meetings and you're all in together, that's got to be kind of a more fun experience maybe, unless you're just going as one guy being overwhelmed by the whole event.
Yeah, I don't think I would ever do it the other way. I don't think I could. I don't think I would ever go to the Olympics at this point as sort of a one-person shop or two-person shop. Having been with Sports Illustrated, sort of seeing how much support you need to really cover the event as best as possible. I mean, even to the point where we always have what we would call fixers, basically locals who are helping us cover stories in whatever city the Olympics in or whatever country the Olympics are in. So I can imagine how tough that might be because, you know, there's a camaraderie element in that we have an office at every Olympics at Sports Illustrated, so we're going somewhere. We can sit, we can all watch things together, at least those of us who are not assigned to that particular event. So that's very good. It just sort of feels like everything is coordinated and there's a group togetherness where, you know, those who I've known who have covered Olympics sort of as the only person for their paper, even if they're a columnist, it's a rough go. Usually what happens, at least with the American columnists, is they usually travel in packs. So, right. You know, if there's one person from the Buffalo News, one person from the Columbus Dispatch, one person from the LA Times, they usually all go to the same event, and even though the stories will be different, they're all covering the same thing. A lot of times that's how the American columnists would do it. So if nothing else, you don't feel like you're sort of doing everything on your own.
Right. Well, we are talking to Richard Deitch from Sports Illustrated. He's at Richard Deitch, D-E-I-T-C-H. Wanted to talk to you about a couple of different reasons. Number one, you're at Sports Illustrated, and the whole idea of when I was growing up reading Sports Illustrated, the whole idea of wanting to someday work for Sports Illustrated continues to kind of resonate in my head, even though, you know, I'm with CBS Sports, that dream, you know, is still tough to kill. And I had John Walters on a few weeks ago, I guess, and his story about how he got to Sports Illustrated and just climbing through the reporting ranks and, you know, fact checking was so fascinating to me. And also the fact you're a media critic, is just, in this day and age, is really interesting to me, so I'm glad you could come on. Just a little bit of background. How did you get to Sports Illustrated? John, like I said, had this like the typical, like when I think of somebody who's going into Sports Illustrated, they'll start basically like in the mailroom and work their way up. How was it for you?
Yeah, I don't know if anymore there's any like sort of quote unquote real path to Sports Illustrated anymore. Mine is obviously going to be similar to John's. Because he's a little older than me, but you know, we're relatively of the same era. My path to SI was I went to school at the University of Buffalo as an undergrad, covered the Bills and Sabres for a couple of years up there. Then I went to grad school at Columbia, the graduate school of journalism, and then got an internship at SI for Kids as a grad student. SI for Kids hired me after my internship was over, and then Sports Illustrated hired me from SI for Kids. So that's probably not a career path most people will have these days, because you're usually bouncing around at like a number of different places. So I got pretty lucky there. And then at Sports Illustrated, very similar to John's sort of career arc, I would imagine. I started as a reporter, which is fact-checking. So I fact-checked for both the magazine and for our commemorative division, which, you know, back then was actually sometimes going out and reporting live, and also a lot of work in-house, basically checking the facts of everything in a story. So I've fact-checked for people from Frank DeFore to Scott Price to Gary Smith to, you know, Tom Verducci to you name it. When I started out, I was the tennis reporter. So I worked a lot with John Wertheim and Scott Price back then as sort of like the third or fourth wheel covering tennis, U.S. Opens, Wimbledons, et cetera. Then I got promoted to writer-reporter, started doing a little more writing, covered, you know, many different things from college basketball, college football. I'm trying to think of my next thing. I think at a certain point when I was a writer-reporter, I started working for SI for Women. That doesn't exist anymore, but Sandy Bailey, who's now Sandy Rosenbush, who's now a news editor at ESPN, was the editor-in-chief of that publication. She hired me to be an associate editor at SI for Women. And so I edited it in-house there, as well as did a lot of writing for SI for Women. So that got me to another division at Sports Illustrated. And to sort of wind down this long and rambling resume, I've worked for SI Swimsuit. I've worked for the commemorative division. Now pretty much my base of operations is SI.com. In terms of the media stuff, which is something John had done before I did, probably about like maybe 8 or 9 years ago, we had a lot of media, we had a media column basically in SI, the magazine, and it was sort of a rotating thing that a number of us used to do. And I was part of that rotation. I think they just basically liked my part of the rotation. And then when I moved a lot of my base of operations to the web, I was the one who pitched them on, can we try to expand our media coverage online? Because the sort of the possibilities were infinite. You could do far more coverage. You could sort of change the form. You could, I'll tell you sort of about the web. You can do anything, basically, which kind of made it really interesting. And not a lot of people were doing it on the web at the time. I mean, Rudy Marsky was sort of doing it for USA Today, and that was kind of the place where I think most people went to for sports media. But I think I just caught it early. I caught the sort of doing sports media on the web early, even before Deadspin did it, and that sort of changed the game a little bit in terms of that type of coverage. And so, you know, for the last, I'd say, 8 years or so, I've, you know, filed pretty consistently for SI.com. I also still write for the magazine at different times, including I do women's basketball for them. So I've been pretty fortunate just in that I've been able to work for pretty much every division at SI with a number of different jobs, from editing to writing, and, knock on wood, I'll continue there. But I know what John is saying, because there's no doubt when I first started, it was very hard to get a byline in there. I mean, I remember my first story ever for Sports Illustrated was a catching up with on a guy named Howie Young. He's a defenseman for the Red Wings in the 60s. He drank himself out of the league. He was an alcoholic, and then he turned his life around by being a bus driver for Navajo kids in New Mexico. Wow. And it took months to get that story in. I remember how excited I was just to even get my first byline in Sports Illustrated. But back then, it was hard. It was like, you had to go through, 20, 25 talented people just to get a byline in the magazine. So it was always a struggle. It's easier now because you have the web and the staff is just smaller. But I certainly know what John was talking about. There was always so much talent at that place that you really had to sort of fight just to get a story in there.
I wanted to know what it was like to fact check Frank DeFord, one of the titans of our business of the last, half century. What was that like?
He's tall. He looks like Clark Gable.
he's very tall.
It was interesting. He was actually a guy who had really, he had a lot of notes, which kind of surprised me a lot. Like, he brought, I believe the Ford story that I think I fact checked two of them, but the one I really remember is Anna Kournikova was on the front of SI. It was a profile of Anna Kournikova that Ford did. And he brought in this gigantic folder just with like clips, handwritten notes, index cards, and that was like the basis I used as my kind of research tool to fact check that. And obviously we talked on the phone. You got to remember, the internet was not as everything was not as easily accessible on the internet. Maybe I was using Nexus at the time. I don't exactly remember. But DeFord's folder, so much of that was ultimately what I ended up fact-checking. So I used a combination of his folder, calling DeFord, and obviously, I don't think I ever talked to Anna, but I probably talked to her agents and other people around her to check the story. But it was great, man. I mean, this was a guy I read as a kid, and it was just like, kind of incredible to, just to be working with the guy. And again, like I said, I think I fact checked another DeFord story, although I don't remember. And I was one time out with him. If I remember right, I helped him. I would feed him some notes on a story that he was doing on tennis. Basically, as reporters, a lot of times they would, we'd have to go out and, go interview this person, type up your notes and send it to Frank kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I did that. I've certainly done that a lot for Gary Smith and Scott Price, Wertheim, et cetera. And especially as a young reporter, that was really cool. I mean, again, these were guys who I had read as a kid in the magazine. And just to be, part of their story at all was incredible. I think one of the reasons why I was able to stick early was, especially in tennis, man, I was just so obsessive with my notes. I mean, every U.S. Open I would cover my first couple of years. I would type up like on a daily basis, like 9 pages of notes and send it to the editors. I mean, literally if one sentence was used in those 9 pages, that would have been a lot, but I just kind of wanted to show them just how like into it I was. And so, so it was pretty cool. I mean, it was just, you know, to be sort of part of like these people whose bylines you read as a kid who you thought were such literary giants. To just even be a little small part of the stories were pretty cool.
No, I mean, I felt the same way. I did some research on Joe Posnanski's second book, the one about the Cincinnati Reds, the Big Red
right.
Machine. And it was the same thing. I was doing some, I had to go through all the clips in the Cincinnati Library of all the Cincinnati Post and Cincinnati Enquirer clips. I think from like 19, it must have been 1976. So that whole season, after like a homestand, you get dizzy from all the the microfilm going by. But yeah, I felt the same way.
That's cool though, man. That's what a great year. Like the Big Red Machine was at its height.
I know, but it was fun. I mean, just and then you see my name in the book, like as part of the acknowledgement section was really cool. So I can definitely relate to that. The whole thing about media critics really interests me, especially online, and I guess we see more and more of it now. I mean, especially with Deadspin, and I've actually had John Koebling on the podcast before he went to the New York Times. But you know, guys like Awful Announcing, it seems like there's just so much, I guess, attention paid to that, and I don't know if regular fans care about media criticism or not, but I think it's a good thing that there's so much critiquing of it. What's your goal? What's your goal because you are the media critic for SI, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, first off, I would say this. I don't think of myself as a critic. Others can use that term, and that's certainly fine, and that's their choice. I think of myself as a writer who covers sports media, and I think that's an important distinction to start with that I make, because if you read what I write, hopefully, you know, most of it or a lot of it is reported. It's reported out stuff. There's a lot of stories that I do that I would consider reportage, not criticism, you know, including news breaks on talent and stuff like that. So while there's no doubt that I know a lot of people will refer to me as that, that's not how I think of myself. That's not sort of the journalistic ethos I even go forth with. I think of it as sort of covering a beat. In the same way, I think like a baseball writer would cover a beat, or in the same way, like someone covering Washington would cover what they do. So I think of myself as a writer who just happens to cover sports media. That said, there's no doubt that within the stuff that I write, and certainly on Twitter, there's an element of critique to it. There's no doubt that that's sort of part of the sports media landscape. So what I try to do is I hope to find a mix or a middle between both of those worlds, where I'm not just someone who's just all you get from me is sprouting opinion, and all you get from me, hopefully I'm never someone who does a screed, but hopefully, you know, that's not what you get from my content if you're reading me. Hopefully you are educated, you learn something, you're getting information, and within all that, certainly there are times I will give you my opinion on what something is in television, or on the internet, radio, et cetera. So, you know, I don't know how the Awful Announcing guys approach it, or Deadspin, or Phil Mushnick, Raceman, who, you know, John Orand, whoever does this kind of stuff now. But I'm really trying to sort of live in both those worlds, because I think if you only lived in the world of the critic, it's a little dangerous to maybe become either irrelevant or to become what you despise, and that's not going to happen to me. I'm not going to do that. I have interest beyond the sports media. While I think it's fun and I think it's great, I'm not sure this is what I'm going to do forever. I think it's important, and I think it's an underserved news content source for a lot of websites, a lot of newspapers, because I think I can make the argument, I think the metrics would even prove it out, that like, you know, somebody like Joe Buck is more famous than, you know, 19 of the 23 members of a baseball team, or 24 members of a baseball team, or, you know, you can identify Chris Berman more than you can identify, you know, 47 of the 53 people who play in the NFL on a given team. So I people care about this, and I think it's very clear they care about this, certainly from those who read me, those who follow me on Twitter and the other people in the space. But I really try hard to be both a reporter in the space as well as an observer and a commenter in the space. I don't know if that makes me different, but I think that keeps me. I don't know. Maybe it sounds a little too self-serving. I think it keeps me interesting to people who are reading me, because I think, again, the danger is if you go to, you know, the danger is, like, I respect the career of Phil Mushnick, but I find sometimes that he screeds so much that the danger is you become sort of a caricature of yourself, and that's not something that's going
to
happen to me.
Right, and you at some point you just want to turn it off and just say, you know what, I'm tired of it. But
correct.
No, you're right. I mean, your Monday, the stuff that comes out on Monday, the whole, and there's obviously a lot of reporting that you do in that, and the roundtable discussions that have been great. I mean, even like, I covered the NFL, but when you did I can't remember, you talked to like Mike Kliss from the Denver, and you had a roundtable.
Yeah,
the NFL
I did a whole like 7 beat writers basically, and sort of, let them, give them a forum to sort of talk about how they cover, you know, the largeness that it is the NFL.
And the Super Bowl. I think it was the Super Bowl you were talking
right,
about.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was really cool.
The Super Bowl, too, exactly.
But it also seems, so I can definitely understand that. It also seems that you're an advocate, too, just because there's so much talk about Skip Bayless on Twitter and Outside the Lines. Do you feel like when something like Outside the Lines is you feel is getting the short stick, or we're being force-fed Skip Bayless, it's important for you to kind of, I don't know if you're sticking up for viewers, but to kind of voice your opinion that way.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's no doubt that there are certain things that I would absolutely fall into the advocacy tag on. Outside the Lines was absolutely one in terms of, in terms of the show is a show I really admire the people who are on, and I think they do really good work. And ESPN moved it from its main network to ESPN2, and the result was a 70% drop in audience. And so, you know, there's no doubt that I used whatever platform I had to try to call them out on that, because on the one hand, they would continue to say how important it is to the core of what they do, but they weren't backing that up with a time slot where people could see it. So that was certainly one that that I would call myself an advocate. And I think anybody, again, who sort of follows me either on Twitter or reads my stuff kind of knows what I think of First Take and sort of the danger of manufactured debate at a place like ESPN, which generally speaking does a lot of good work. But, that show in particular, I think, just really does not speak well for them. They do a lot of things just to sort of create news, a lot of news manufacturing. And I think that kind of stuff, I mean, that's at a certain level. When it's really, really bad, it gets into race baiting and other nonsense. So I think that ultimately hurts them as a product, and that's where I think it's very fair to say, hey, aren't you getting into critique here? Absolutely, when it comes to stuff like Outside the Lines and First Take, I'm far more of a critic than I am, a quote-unquote traditional reporter. So, I try to sort of work both lines, and I totally can understand when people are saying, hey, you should be one or the other, or hey, you're only one or the other. I get that. So I'm, in my own way, I'm also trying to create a little bit of a new form of somebody who could sort of go back and forth in this world.
What's one of the most entertaining things about your Twitter account, Richard Deitch, is the Twitter wars you get into quite a bit, and especially with Darren Revelle. But also with Clay Travis and Jason Whitlock and Dan Le Batard over the years.
The Fab Five, Alex.
They're fun to watch, and it's fun to go back and forth. Does it serve a larger purpose, or is it just entertaining for you? Or I guess when
yeah, that's a good question. No, I mean, listen, it's a fair question. When people start thinking of me more for that than anything else, then that's not a good place for me to be, and sometimes people do that certainly with Revelle, and that's when I say to myself, man, I got to dial this back, because this is not very smart. Yeah, it's not smart. There's no doubt. Listen, there's always going to be an element of entertainment to it. You are on a public forum like that. There's no doubt that there's a little bit of showmanship to it, and anybody who says, or anybody who denies that, is just not being honest, and I'd be the first to admit that that's part of it. But generally speaking, with those guys, behind all that, there's a lot of truth. I mean, the stuff that Revelle and I have gotten into is very, very specific to philosophy of how we both approach things, in terms of journalism. He has a certain viewpoint of what he thinks journalism is, and I do as well. And they are, you know, incredibly counter for the most part to one another. You know, the stuff with Clay Travis, I don't think he considers himself a journalist, but, you know, there's certainly issues about a guy, to me, who sort of just intentionally trolls for traffic. You know, and I'm sure he has his issues in me as well. And it's been a while since Whitlock and I have danced, but he has his issues with me and many others at Sports Illustrated. That's not going to change, and he's very, very good at getting attention for himself. So I guess the best way to answer that is there's no doubt that sometimes they're fun, but I always want to make sure that I'm not becoming too much of a part of the circus, if that makes any sense, because when that happens, then that takes away from any kind of impact I would have. So, you know, I have to even sort of watch myself and monitor myself so that that doesn't become what people think of me or people know about me, or, you know, I lose sort of a little bit of credibility. So while there's no doubt, like, they're sometimes fun, there's no doubt that there's a bit of showmanship to it, I honestly do in the back of my own mind always sort of want to, like, remind myself, you know, like, just be careful that you're not going down a clown show road too much, because, you know, you do want to maintain some authenticity for people who are following.
Well, and I wonder this too, because I asked John Coebling this when he was with Deadspin. I asked John Walters this, before, I guess right when he got to Newsweek, was, do you worry about burning bridges? Because in this media landscape, when no jobs are really secure, I mean, SI just went through, just laid off one of their high-profile football writers. Do you worry about burning bridges? Because one day, I mean, who knows what our job situation is like? You may have to try and get a job somewhere else. Does that worry you at all?
Of course it worries me. But, you know, and, you know, there's no doubt that I think at this point, I mean, I'd be very surprised if ESPN ever hired me in the future. But that said, I think ultimately I owe it to the readers who are reading me now for me to be honest about what I see, what I do, what I report. So that's how I approach that, knowing full well that the landscape is tough and all our jobs may be up for grabs and I may have to one day apply to a place where I've been critical of. But I guess the hope is twofold there. One, you know, if it's a place I can sort of understand that the what I've written has come from a reported, honest place, you'd hope that a place would be smart enough to know that and then judge somebody on their own merits. If they didn't, I don't think that's a place I'd want to work for anyway. And then secondly, ultimately, you have to sort of make a decision. Like, you got to make a decision where, are you sort of always eyeing for the next job? Are you eyeing to be sort of famous? Or are you eyeing to really, like, honor the reader who is willing to invest time in reading you? And so while there's no doubt that, you know, there's probably places I probably will never be able to work because of some of the things I've written, at least I know I was straight. You know, at least I know that I dealt the reader straight. I wasn't behind the scenes trying to, you know, shape my career so I can get a spot on Sports Reporters or something like that. I was reporting and being honest with them and telling them what I thought at that time. So yeah, there's no doubt you think about it, but I think ultimately at a certain point you got to make a choice, and I made that choice, and I'm going to have to live with it, good, better, and different.
Well, and the readers benefit because, like I said, the Twitter wars are fun to read, but also the Monday morning stuff and the reporting is well done. And it's needed in local media when you're talking about media criticism, but it's needed on a national level as well. And so I think it's great, and I appreciate you joining me on the podcast. And thanks so much, man. It was fun. I've been wanting to get you on for a while. I'm glad we could finally do it.
Yeah, thanks, man. Listen, as I see your list of luminaries before me, you know, the Amory Cox of the world, et cetera, I'm in very impressive company, so thank you.
Well, you only add to the luster, man. Thanks.
Nice bluster.